משנה מקום מסביב לשתיקות שלך, מפנה מקום בלב ללחיצות שלך, מפנה מקום בבטן שאוכל לבלוע אותך, אני מפנה מקום בתיבה למכתבים שלך.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us in the studio is Gershom Gorenberg, a Jerusalem-based historian and journalist who has written for the New York Review of Books, the New York Times, The Atlantic, and Haaretz. He's a senior correspondent for The American Prospect and blogs at southjerusalem.com. His books include The Accidental Empire, Israel and the Birth of Settlements, 1967 to 77, The End of Days, Fundamentalism and the Struggle for the Temple Mount, and his new book just out is The Unmaking of Israel. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gershom Gorenberg.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And just to, before we get into the book, obviously there's some news being made here in the United States with the eviction of the protesters from Zuccotti Park. But in Israel, there's some serious news being made in terms of two bills that critics say would threaten the independence of the country's Supreme Court. And this happening just after cabinet members had advanced another proposal to sharply limit overseas funding for dovish groups in Israel. So in terms of what is happening in Israel, can you make a case, which many do, that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government is trying to stifle dissent and pluralism?
I think that he's not only trying to stifle dissent, but more specifically, both of these bills are designed to prevent criticism from the public and judicial review of what's going on in the occupied territories. This is a backlash from the right to human rights activities and to judicial intervention in illegal activities by the government in the occupied territories over the last several years. So what's going on is that the right-wing government is trying to gag the opposition to the settlement policies and to the occupation policies. It's a sign that you can't have an occupation, a essentially undemocratic situation just over an unmarked border between Israel and the West Bank and expect for the problems of the West Bank not to leak back into Israel.
And in terms of shutting down the funding for dovish groups, that has been met with a lot of anger from abroad. What's the local reaction?
Well, it's a very high-profile issue within Israel itself. There's been very, very serious public objection. There's been strong amount of objection within the legal system to these kinds of moves. There's no guarantee that the government will get this through. But even if they don't get it through, it's an effort to delegitimize criticism of policies and particularly those policies that are being carried out in the West Bank. It's a sign that the contradictions get stronger and stronger. On the one hand, human rights activity, objections to the occupation, free discussion grow in Israel. And on the other hand, there's an attempt by the right to defend the status quo. And when all else fails, they're now trying to use their legislative majority to stifle dissent. What I would say on a deeper level is again, this shows that you can't separate the internal situation in Israel over time from what's going on in the occupied territories. Ultimately, if there's an unhealthy or worse situation in the occupied territories, it's going to affect the state of democracy within Israel itself.
And Gershom Gorenberg, let's talk about the other occupied part of Israel, which is analogous to the Occupy Wall Street movement, and that is the demonstrations that have been taking place for some time now, culminating in hundreds of thousands of people protesting. What Israel and the United States have in common is the dubious distinction of being first and second in the world in disparity of wealth, where you have a growing group of wealthy oligarchs in Israel, many of them buying up the media, and then you have the rest of us. And that is very much reflects the 99% versus the 1% movement here in the United States.
Yeah, I would say that in Israel it's the 99.9% versus the 0.1%. Policies pursued over the last 25 years have transformed Israel from a social democracy with a very high degree of social equality to a society with vast income disparities. One of the reason that that's been able to take place is that the political agenda is so focused on the future of the territories, on essentially one foreign affairs and defense issue, that parties have ceased to have a personality on other issues. You may have a multi-party system, but on economics it became a one-party system. And the social protest movement that erupted this summer is a popular rebellion against that. The extent of its popularity and its support stunned everyone, even though looking at the economic situation, that shouldn't have been a surprise. The largest single protest brought out 7% of the Israeli population. That's equivalent to Occupy Wall Street being able to get 20 million people to march in the streets of American cities. I mean, it's a huge social protest movement. The problem that it faces is that as long as a kind of political triage goes on where the issue that people vote on is the future of the occupied territories, should Israel keep them, should Israel give them up, then it's very difficult to organize and produce change on the economic issue. I should just add one point here as well, which is that that original transition from social democracy to neoliberal free market economics took place in the 80s under strong pressure from the Reagan administration. And I want to underline that because it shows an irony of immense proportions. The United States was willing to pressure Israel on economic policy. It was willing to pressure Israel to stop subsidizing food, basic food products that went mainly to the poor. It was willing to pressure Israel to take a sharp free market turn. It seems much less willing to pressure Israel on settlement policy.
Again, I'm joined in the studio by Gershom Gorenberg, a Jerusalem-based historian and journalist who is the author of a new book, The Unmaking of Israel. So obviously, this is a different country from the socialist kibbutz image that we have from the founding, going back to the Exodus. And I guess your hometown, Jerusalem, is a hell of a lot different, even from the days of Teddy Kollek when he was mayor.
Oh, yes. There's been a sharp change. As you said, the social democracy side of Israel has been suffering. The focus of politics has been on the occupied territories. In Jerusalem, there's been a rising influence of the ultra-Orthodox community. One of the subjects that I explain in the book is how inadvertently by policies which nobody realized would have that effect, the Israeli government actually created the ultra-Orthodox, the quickly growing ultra-Orthodox community in Israel, a community which takes extreme religious positions and is heavily dependent on government handouts to exist because most of the men don't work. They spend their lives in religious study. So that's changed the nature of Jerusalem as a city because Jerusalem is one of the major centers. In the long term, it poses an economic threat to the country. But even more basically, the kind of education that the ultra-Orthodox community gives its children with state funding doesn't prepare them for modern economic life or perhaps more importantly for modern democratic life. And it's in such desperate need of housing that it's become part of the settlement coalition because secular governments have provided cheap housing to the ultra-Orthodox in the simple deal that they move to West Bank settlements. So they've become part of the coalition of opportunity supporting continued growth of the settlements.
And you say that it's a problem in as much as what the ultra-Orthodox have big families. Is that creating the demographic problem?
Right, because through state support, funding for men to stay to marry young and to stay in religious study, a change has gone on during the history of Israel, where members of this community who used to marry at the same age and have the same size family as other Israelis tend now to marry around the age of 20 and have very large families. And this has become sort of a social Ponzi scheme. In the beginning, it was a small number supported by the government and working parents. Now the parents themselves aren't working, and the dependence on the government is more extreme. There is an economic crisis in that community itself, but it's an economic drag on the country as a whole. And as I said, these are people who aren't getting any education for participating either in a modern workforce or a modern democracy. So one of the recommendations of my book is that there's a need for finally instituting a separation between state and religion in Israel, and educational and vocational programs to move the ultra-Orthodox into the workforce and to require a basic modern education in their schools.
And Gershom Goldberg, I have heard it said before that if Israel and the Palestinians were to come to an agreement, that the next civil war, if you will, in Israel would be between the religious and the secular. I mean, you're describing a serious divide, and I imagine secular taxpaying Israelis are not too happy with this situation.
Well, the divide is not precisely along a religious secular lines, because there are people who are religious, like myself, who oppose the settlement effort, who oppose this continued subsidy for the ultra-Orthodox and so forth. But the risk in a withdrawal, the clear social problem, and this has served as a deterrent to politicians making the necessary decisions, is a social conflict between the mainstream and the settlers, or the most extreme elements of the settlers. And the fear of internal strife, or even internal violence, is something that can prevent politicians from making necessary decisions, because in any society, internal conflict is even more frightening than conflict on the outside. It's with people you know. It's with people who are considered part of the society. The fear of confronting that has been one of the reasons that politicians have been unwilling to stop the growth of the settlement or to take the necessary steps to reach a peace agreement.
So there is an impression that this current government in Israel is feeling a little paranoid. And there were leaks recently from Maya Dagan, the former head of Mossad, and other senior defense officials that Netanyahu government is increasingly isolated in the region. You've got the tectonic changes in Egypt, and Israel's friendship with Turkey is now in tatters. And then you've got the Palestinian statehood issue. You've got the increasing concern about Iran getting a nuclear weapon. And the general impression one gets is that this is a much more isolated and paranoid government. But is it also an isolated and paranoid polity in general in the country?
I'd say it's a very divided polity on two levels. It's a divided polity between those who would like to make a turn toward a peace process and toward a two-state solution, and those who want to circle the wagons. And it's a divided polity in the sense that many of the people in the center, and I think this is a classic characteristic of political centers, it's not that they have centrist positions. They have positions in both directions at once, and they're affected by the affairs of the moment, pulled each way because in this case, they understand that a two-state solution is necessary and they're afraid of paying the price for it. I think that one of the things that has to be stressed is that support for a two-state solution, which in the 1980s, for instance, was a radical, way off the map position among both Israelis and Palestinians, has become a mainstream position on both sides. This is one of the incredible ironies of the situation, that even though the growth of the settlements in particular has made it more and more difficult for Israel to pull out, on both sides of the conflict, there's much stronger support for a two-state solution than there was in the past. I think what you're seeing with the government and with the political right is that they feel besieged on two levels. They feel besieged internationally, and they feel besieged internally. That's why they're making efforts to try to stifle dissent, because because they're afraid of the dissent, because they're afraid of the internal criticism.
So given the growing isolation in the region, but I think arguably it's also happened in Europe over the last several decades, the very, very close relations that the early state of Israel had with most European states and friendly relations have dissipated. I think the general attitude amongst Europeans has turned quite hostile towards Israel. Here in the United States, there's still obviously tremendous support for Israel, particularly in the Congress. So when you have this particular Congress under right-wing control talking about Sharia laws, and there's many anti-Sharia laws that have been passed in the Midwest. I mean, there's no possibility on the planet of Sharia law having any traction in the United States, but they're passing these preemptive laws to stop it. And so there's this kind of weird anti-Muslim paranoia. But from listening to you and from looking at your book, The Unmaking of Israel, Gershom Gorenberg, and discussion we just had about the growing influence of the Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox community, you know, why are we so paranoid about, you know, Muslim Sharia law in Egypt, for example, when you're complaining about it in your own country, Israel?
Well, I want to make a more general point here. The problem here is not religion as such. The problem is which mix of religion with which modern ideologies. There's a characteristic that goes on in Christianity, in Islam, and in Judaism that the reactionary right presents itself as old-time religion. Old-time religion is a modern invention. It's a mix between religion and reactionary modern political philosophies. And you have that problem in various forms in the Christian and Muslim worlds and in Israel. To relate to the anti-Islam paranoia in the United States, I'm going to call up an incident from the past. In Kissinger's memoirs, he discusses the first elections in Portugal after the fall of the dictatorship. And the Socialist Party won, and Kissinger regarded that as a win for Moscow. Instead of saying the dictatorship has fallen, Portugal has rejoined the democratic West, they had free elections, all he could do was see things in these harsh and distorting Cold War terms. And I think that happens in relationship to the Middle East today when you're talking about Islam. The question is not the West versus Islam. The question is which kind of Islam. The question in Israel is not religion versus a progressive vision. It's which kind of religion. And when you put things in those distorting, binary, Manichaean frameworks, you're not in any position to deal with the reality because you've divided everything into these simplistic categories.
So turning to your book, Gershom Gorenberg, The Unmaking of Israel, you're calling for ending the occupation, guaranteeing full equality, separating state from synagogue, and none of them is singularly are small undertakings. Together, they're major undertakings. But you're arguing that not only is this possible, it's essential. Yet I see an Israel that is moving to the right, former President Bill Clinton says a lot of it's to do with the Russian immigration. That's his argument that has changed the country. So how is this possible? Because there are, you know, we talked about analogies between the Occupy movement and Israel in terms of disparity of wealth. But there's also, I think, analogies as well, you know, progressives in this country spend all their time complaining about how feckless the Democratic Party is. And I imagine progressives in Israel are basically given up on labor as well.
Well, there's a tremendous dissatisfaction with the parties of the supposed left that have become ineffectual. But I would say that both of the economic movements that you mentioned show that politics doesn't move in a continuous line. When the tensions between the realities with which people are living and the failures of the political system reach a particular point. There's the crisis has the possibility of bringing major changes. The last time that we saw this in a very strong way in Israel is that the political stalemate of the 1980s and the first Palestinian uprising and the pressures of those situations brought to power Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, who made what was then the radical change of beginning to negotiate with the Palestinians based on a program that was pointed toward a two-state solution. I would also note that Rabin did something else. For the first time, he had a political alliance with the Arab-backed parties in Israel, which was a step toward the full equality that I'm talking about. So the very degree of crisis is something that it doesn't mean that you're stuck, that you can't get anywhere. I regard pessimism as a luxury, and it's a luxury engaged in by people who either don't really feel like the situation affects them directly or who have given up or who are at a distance. Pessimism paralyzes you. I would say, yes, we're looking at a crisis, and that crisis is an opportunity to present significantly different political options. You were speaking before the United States. I would say the same thing is true in Israel. You have to mobilize people's feeling of frustration and point it in a new direction. And part of the reason that I wrote this book is to say, okay, yes, we have a problem. We have to look it directly in the face, describe it, describe the symptoms so that we can face it. And then it's possible to propose major changes.
So given that there's a despondence here and a lot of us to do, I think, with the unrealistic expectations of a leader in the form of Barack Obama, that in American democracy, people treat voting like going to the dentist. It's just something you do as a duty every 2 years. So you punch your ticket.
Or every 4 years.
But you do it, you punch your ticket for democracy and then you go away. And then that's supposed to be it. Whereas obviously in the real world, political activism is a 24/7 occupation. Given the dismal lack of leadership on the left in Israel, is there anything that's going to galvanize this movement that you're calling for?
Well, I think that we've already seen one sign that that's possible with the social protests, with the so-called July 14th movement of the summer, that at a moment when people had said Israelis had given up on politics, that they'd become passive, you had this huge level of political involvement. I'm going to say this again. When you get 7% of a country's population on the streets on the same night, you're obviously not dealing with political passivity. In fact, in this respect, I have to be I think it's realistic to be more optimistic about social change in Israel than in the United States, because Israel has a much deeper tradition of strong political and social involvement on the part of the populace. Elections aren't only something that takes place every 4 years, that the multi-party system means that more perspectives are represented in the political system. There's higher expectations of the state being responsible for the citizenry. Each individual is out for himself or herself. Ethic of America doesn't really have a history in Israel. And for all those reasons, the potential for political involvement is higher. And I think that already the social protest movement of the summer has been an earthquake in the existing political parties. There's cracks in them. There's politicians trying to look for new ways to frame themselves before the next elections, which are at most 2 years off and could be sooner in a parliamentary system. We haven't yet seen what the full impact of that will be.
Well, let's just turn in the last few minutes then to the changing foreign policy landscape. You mentioned obviously the huge changes in Egypt, But what's going on to the north in Syria, north of Israel and Syria, of course, has already affected Hamas, which has pivoted towards the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, away from the Assads, this family of murderers, murderous clan.
Hamas is in a terrible bind now.
Yeah, and now you've got the confrontation with Iran. Iran's in a terrible bind, arguably, if they lose Syria. But on the other hand, everybody's warning that the people that could really put a fly in the ointment are the Israelis if they attack Iran. And one of the peculiar things about this current situation is it looks like the Saudis are actually urging the Israelis to attack. I know that's not a factual thing, but that is, in effect, they are both on the same page.
Well, what that shows you is that, again, you can't deal with the Middle East in binary. It's not a game of chess. There's not one side on one side of the chessboard and one side on the other side. The turmoil in Syria weakens both Hezbollah and Hamas. Hamas has been in a terrible bind since the beginning of the uprising in Syria because it's linked with the Muslim Brotherhood, which is anti-Syrian regime. And on the other hand, it was enjoying support from the Syrian regime. The Assad regime wanted Hamas to come out against the uprising. It couldn't do that because it would be alienating its own base if it did that. It's been caught in a position of silence, which leaves it with both the base and the supporters unhappy with it. So the turmoil in the region changes the players. It creates the possibilities of change. It also puts more pressure on Israel in the long run because in the past it was possible to cut deals with the dictators, most obviously with Mubarak. To the extent that democracy breaks out in the Arab world, in order to maintain the peace agreements, which are crucial for Israel's security, it's going to have to make more sense of its policy to Arab public opinion. And the only way to accomplish that is through a peace deal with the Palestinians. The big question, since we're, you know, having this conversation in Los Angeles in the United States, is what is the United States going to do about this? Is the United States going to continue essentially being passive in Middle East diplomacy, or is it going to move back in and really become the facilitator of a peace process?
Well, on that note, I thank you for joining us here in the studio, Gershom Gorenberg. And also, thank you for your new book, The Unmaking of Israel.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Gershom Gorenberg, as an historian and journalist who's written for the New York Review of Books, the New York Times, the Atlantic, and Haaretz. He's a senior correspondent for the American Prospect and blogs at southjerusalem.com. His books include The Accidental Empire, Israel and the Birth of Settlements, The End of Days, Fundamentalism and the Struggle for the Temple Mount, and the new book just out, The Unmaking of Israel. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. I'm